best mix of music. Guaranteed.
Non-stop music.
FM. Get set for a non-stop music suite. 5 hits in a row. 10 hits in a row. All the hits and more.
Pop lollards. Lollards of pop.
Power. Music pop. Turn it up loud. More crackle-free CD. Non-stop music. All the power we need. All the music you want. Get set for a non-stop music suite.
Simply the best.
Welcome.
Resonance. Resonance. FM 104.4.
And this is Freaky Trigger and the Lollards of Pop. It's a minute or two after noon on Sunday, January 14th, and you're listening to Resonance FM 104.4. Ahead on the program today, new maths. Don't tune out just yet. It's new maths, after all. The fun stuff. We'll discuss what new maths were and why they failed. And badgers in literature. Why are they always so grumpy? Today we reveal for the first time the American Defense Department's response to Public Enemy's Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos, and the Egyptian god of night and chaos, Set, will be summoned to give an account of himself. We'll also listen to Rock Me Bartender from Mummy the Peep Show, Box Set Go, remember them, and Badgers on Acid by Siphoon, K-Complex, and Ting. That's all in the next hour. We're coming to you live today from the Valley of the Kings in Luxor, home of Ramesses II, Ramesses III, so on. Today's Lollards are Cat Stevens, Mark Sinker, and for the first time on this side of the microphone, Pete Barron.
I'm probably last.
Yeah. Back in your box, you. But first, what has gone before? Nonsense, when all is said and done, is still nonsense. But the study of nonsense, that is science. Freaky Trigger, the Internet's one sane collective, drops science so you can pick it back up again. Washing over the transom this week was the news that some estate agents, notably Foxton's, boo, have rechristened Holloway in North London. Do you live in Holloway? Not anymore. It's Hill Martin now, apparently, except that the tube stop still says Holloway, and Holloway Women's Prison remains just that. Maybe they can try Ho-Ho next, like Holloway, Ho-So-Ho.
Yeah,
maybe I'll just let you guys make the jokes. Yeah.
I've thought recently that because it's this area between Holloway Prison and Pensacola Prison, the whole area works basically just on the sexual tension between a men's prison and a woman's prison.
So they could have called it
some sort of not getting any area. I don't know.
I don't really know if that would push the home prices up.
Yeah, I see your point.
Poptimism Lesson 24 is online. You can hear Jeans On by 2Jam featuring MC Junior JC. Yes. It's a cover of the 1976 hit from Lord David Dundas, son of the 3rd Marquess of Zetland. I Get Around by Dragonette, and more. All of this can be found by typing www.freakytrigger.co.uk into your web browser. Text in during the show if you'd like. The number is 0777-927-0515. Did I get the right number of sevens in there? 0777, as you say. 927-0515.
When you do the web address, our webmaster, Scary Alan, hates it when you say www. So
what does he prefer?
Nothing.
It's implied.
Freaky Trigger. But it's
okay,
implied.
Does that work if you just put
works,
in freakytrigger.co.uk?
I think you should annoy him. So keep
also,
going.
You could annoy him more by saying wobbly.
Yeah, true.
Another story this week concerns Phileas Fogg crisps, what I would call potato chips. Once popular, then relaunched, then so elusive as to be invisible, the little foil packets with a mustachioed gentleman on the front were thought to have vanished completely until one of our spies found some on Oxford Street. But with a light blue wrapper and the legend thankfully cool, something strange has happened to the face of the high-class British crisp. Further investigation reveals the full lineup of flavors. spike and lime tortillas. Cool casa tortillas.
Sounds a bit radical.
Chili con queso tortillas. Kalonji seed papadoms. Teriyaki crackers. Brie and onion toasts. Sounds more normal. Phileas Fogg stuff. Black olive and pesto crostini. Mark, have you tried any of these new flavors?
Well, the problem was because that our spy actually ran off with all the packets himself and didn't deliver them to the studio. So the answer there is no. But we're going to do the taste test now in a radio first by actually eating Walker sensations while we're doing a taste test on Phileas Fogg crisps, which mostly aren't potato chips.
No.
They're the other sort of chips, corn snacks.
So really not potato chips at all?
No, this was their breakthrough, was to move off into the...
There were plenty of cheap corn snacks beforehand. I mean, there was Space Raiders.
No, but they were expensive corn snacks.
And the big breakthrough of Phileas Fogg was obviously that they were posh snacks. They were the first real posh snacks in British snacking history.
But to me, to me, copying Doritos doesn't seem very posh.
No, that was another of their breakthroughs. I think it was essentially that they went for things which were not posh, but they colonised them.
And they were foreign.
This ghost of the British Empire went out and seized.
But who's colonizing who? If you look at that lineup, it's like at least 50%, you know, cool casa. It seems to me like Frito-Lay has colonized Phileas Fogg rather than the other way around.
The key point about Phileas Fogg was that their biggest selling snack was their tortilla chips. I mean, we hadn't had tortilla chips in this country before. Uh-huh. So it came at about the mid-80s where suddenly Mexican food, which we've always been terrible at in this country, suddenly this came forward. And the original version was, the Phileas Fogg character, Jules Verne, around the world in 80 days, going around the world, writing to his Aunt Agatha about these great crisps he's had and so on. And this man with the top hat and, a passepartout as well, was, a staple of the snacking scene until probably the early noughties, and when they tried their terrible rebrand, which...
And what was that? What did that involve?
Well, Phileas Fogg vanished himself.
And they had...
this Phileas Fogg, you mean the man with the mustache front?
He was no longer on the front. And on the back, there was a little photo romance story of a vaguely round pink... touristy person called Pat who seemed to be sexually menacing.
Yeah, let's be fair, it was sex tourist.
A fit Indian lady or a fit Thai lady who was trying to get on with making her spice.
Taking time out from fanning Charlotte Church, obviously.
Oh, so the paradigm you're saying was shifting from a sort of hilarious, jaunty tourism to Phileas Fogg, your partner in free trade.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. It was a pan globalization as opposed to empire globalization.
It was gap year Phileas Fogg in a lot of ways, and of course no one wants to associate themselves with those gap year muppets going around doing exactly the same thing as everyone else in Thailand every year, and so therefore the brand died on its ass.
Hence, us being unable, despite our best effort. I mean, we must have looked for at least 4 or 5 minutes for these Phileas Fogg crisps and couldn't find them at all.
I thought our story was that our spy ran away with them because they were so delicious.
Oh, is that what it was?
Well, I mean, our spy was up in arms that the corn casa tortillas were in a blue packet, as she saw being ripped off wholly from Doritos, as you pointed out earlier. Not so in this country. The pure powder blue packet was originally a Phileas Fogg invention.
Yeah. Not to be confused with the dark blue packet, which is, of course, cheese and onion flavour.
Mm. Pete, you've got a song for us. What is it?
Well, funnily enough, because one of the things you can do with Phileas Fogg snacks is on their website, you can buy a whole box set of their snacks. And it costs £10 for one packet of each of these crisps, which seems absolutely ridiculous. But go to WW Phileas Fogg and you'll see this special box set. And my song is Box Set Go by The High.
I'm
go by the high. School teachers are experts at making do with very little. Everyone's always got a plan for how to fix schools, but few of the solutions ever involve giving teachers and parents the resources they need to teach their kids better. Today's mantra is constant testing, as with George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind Act, a name cynically cribbed from progressive educator Marion Wright Edelman's Children Defense Fund, which, of course, condemns the act. But once upon a time, it was thought that maybe teachers were just teaching things wrong. Enter new maths, or as we called it in the United States, new math. Pete, I don't remember new math. I don't remember much math at all, to be honest. Did it teach different stuff from old math, or the same stuff in a new way?
The same stuff in a new way. I mean, what the idea behind the new maths, or new math as you would call it, you fool of American, is that up to that point, basically, you know, maths is quite an abstract thing, and up to that point, there's very much. We're teaching adding, we're teaching multiplication by rote, and somewhere along the line you'll make a connection between the number that you see in the world of you know, bags of crisps and so on, and the number you've been working assiduously to work out the tables of. The idea of new math was, or maths, you've got me doing it now, was that it was first of all to try and make it more concrete. So there was a lot of counting of dots. And there's a lot of here's a chunk
counting of dots.
Yeah. So the idea was that you'd work out.
Isn't that a giant step backward from using numbers in the first place?
Well, the idea is to attach the idea of number to a physical thing, which previously hadn't been done. But at the same time,
I think that previously hadn't been done is
well, no, but false. But it hadn't been formalised in the same sort of way. And the big problem was, of course,
it hadn't been formalised for kids.
Yeah, from an educational point of view, and so a lot of teachers who wouldn't have done that or would have seen that as being a bit dumbing down. Felt that that was a bad thing. At the same time, there was this push to suggest that maths is also just a thing about relations between different groups, mm-hmm. which is where we get into the box set of box set go, which is the Venn diagram. Now, set theory.
A Venn diagram.
Well, the high song is about Venn diagrams.
Yeah, I wasn't
listening properly.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. It's a
I don't think
at all.
Anyone was listening properly.
Well, no, it is a terrible song, and therefore the grace of the Stone Roses go us. The box set go in box set go is the box, which is the universal set, and the set's inside, and then go home afterwards because it's boring. It seems to be the vague idea of the way the song works. It's also about the sound of
stop.
It's also about the sound of government, but I don't really want to talk about
now. What does this have to do with Venn diagrams, and what's a Venn diagram?
Right,
anyway?
Well, a Venn diagram not invented by John Venn, but he gave it its name in the 1880s, is a way of graphically representing set theory. So you have the box, which is the universal set.
Which is everything.
Everything. And you have some circles inside which often intersect and do interesting things, which are usually a small thing. So you'd have, say, a circle representing the number of people with two legs.
Okay.
And another circle representing the number of people with hair.
Okay.
And then there'd be an intersection, which is quite a lot of people, though not Tim. sorry, Tim.
Awkward.
It's basically relational mathematics. And the thing about this is previously, this would be something you'd do. This is actually the linchpin of degree level mathematics. But suddenly this came in, because it's also very simple and quite easily graphically represented. This came in at primary school level, briefly, just to show this kind of relationship of mathematics.
Now, did it work?
It's interesting because I think in some ways it did. I mean, the one of the really interesting things about new maths is it's the last time that educational theory was actually moved forward by educationalists rather than by government. This is actually mathematicians sitting there going, this is a better way of teaching maths.
So were teachers on board with this?
No, an awful lot of them weren't.
So there's a difference between teachers and educationalists.
Always. I mean, and in the end, a good teacher you shouldn't have to muck around with, but of course there are also quite a lot of lousy teachers out there.
Especially, it was considered, especially in mathematics, that there was a large number of people who felt they'd been badly taught in mathematics, because I think there probably were a lot of bad maths teachers, mm-hmm. and it was somehow more evident. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but somehow the stopping point in maths was much more clear than in history or French or something like that.
I think one of the big problems of maths is that if you're good at it or if you know how it works, it's very hard to explain to someone or understand to someone else how it doesn't work. And so It's the idea of putting set theory in this respect was another thing that you could be good at. And one of the really interesting things about it is that actually people who are good at sort of base level arithmetic, you know, just counting and numbers like that, and can get that really quickly, are often actually quite poor at what maths develops into, which is much more abstract.
Okay.
So in this respect, set theory, putting set theory in at this point, if you were good at that, then it kind of said that more of maths might be like this later.
Yeah. But then maybe the kids that were good at numbers, suddenly they're left out.
Yeah,
right?
If they're good at numbers, they're numerate. They can survive in the world. And this is the problem that what people want maths to do.
Okay.
Yes. Essentially the aspect of maths which is useful for everyone is addition, subtraction, multiplication, whatever. But skills at that aren't necessarily related to the kind of skills that you need to develop to pursue maths beyond addition, subtraction, arithmetic.
And was new math designed to provide a ramp up to that stuff?
New maths wanted to get to front load the abstraction and to get the formalized stuff into people's heads much earlier.
It can be hard to get when you're like 6 years old, though, right?
Well, I don't think so, because I never had any problem with it. But thinking about it subsequently, I remember looking at the dots on the frieze on the wall in my primary school, where they were done like domino spots right across the wall, 1 to 20, and sorting them into types as I was not listening during the lesson, just looking at them and thinking about them. And what that rather suggests to me is that I had a bit of an aptitude for abstraction. And in fact, I've always been rather poor, or very poor, at arithmetic, and just careless and not really bothered.
And that's often the case with given mathematicians. They're absolutely lousy at mental arithmetic.
Kat, did you have new maths when you were in school?
It was a little bit early for me, as the youngster in the crew. But my mum was a teacher. She didn't teach maths. She didn't teach primary school, but she didn't teach maths because of the hours she did. And when I was... No eating crisps in the back.
I'm still tasting the test. Or whatever I'm doing.
By the way, I have to say that the chilli sensations are a lot nicer than the roasted chicken with lemon and thyme. That
is sorting into types there, though.
That is the results. Yeah. Yes, exactly. If we drew a Venn diagram...
Are you having enough time?
Well, ooh.
If you had to draw a Venn diagram of these crisps, what would it look like?
Well, I see. We could just like have this can of Cronenberg that's lying between them as the intersection, as like the drink that would go with both flavours.
Okay. But you said your mom was a teacher. She wasn't a maths teacher, but
she wasn't a maths teacher. But as such, there was lots of educational books and things like around the house. And I remember there was. A set of books, like exercise books, with pictures of various, how many ducks are there on this page, how many chickens are there on this page, draw a circle around all the ducks, and try and draw the circle so it excludes the chicken over here.
Proto Venn diagram.
I mean,
what Kat intimates there as well is that it's true that there's an awful lot of primary school teachers out there who scrape their GCSE with their O level in maths. Primary school teachers generally want to be primary school teachers because they like kids and that kind of thing. They're often not very good at maths, and yet it's those people who are actually teaching our kids maths to start off with, which is another reason why new maths came in. And I think the best analogy to make it work for you, Eli, is that new maths is a lot like new Coke, in as much as it promised to do everything that old Coke did, but better, but people took a guinea just because it was new. I've never tasted it.
And by people, you mean math teachers probably a lot.
Math teachers. Oh, parents as well, though, because parents would come in and go, well, last year you said my son was really good at maths. No, he doesn't get these Venn diagrams. He doesn't understand them. It's like, okay, but that's maths as well.
I think one of the elements of it, which was actually quite daring, but it seems to me wasn't explained well, was the fact that it actually... concentrated on the visual element of mathematics, which is fairly important later on, but it wasn't the visual element in the geometry sense. It was an abstract visual element, and in fact subsequently there is a whole area of maths to do with abstract geometry, which is not the geometry that we see around us every day, but other types of geometry.
I mean, one of my favourite jokes that involves maths is one that involves abstraction and topology, which is what Marx intimated to do, which is basically a Simon Munnery joke where...
A joke by who?
Simon Munnery, who I believe is on Resonance between 12 and 1 on Mondays, who basically says, I was walking down the street one day, and it doesn't really matter where the street is, because all streets are the same street topologically, unless it's a runway. And it's true, because every street's connected, so it's all the same streets.
Okay, I guess that's why I don't remember new maths. Kat, you might be a little young to have loved this song. I don't know. It seems like you are the youngster. At least that's what you say. But this song is celebrating, shockingly, its 20th anniversary this year. I think I'm right when I say it was recorded in 1987 in London. It's Public Enemy with Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos.
In your face, London! Everybody in the house, make some noise! I want everybody in the house to say, ho! Yo, Chuck, kick it to him, man!
A ballad behind bars, or you could say real rock from the rock. An unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here is a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been they got me sitting in a state pen? I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me's begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man, and I can never be a veteran. On the streets, the situation's unreal. I got a raw deal, so I'm looking for the steal. Word them up. I'm looking for that steel.
Yo, man, we gonna break you out of there, man. We ain't gonna like that, man.
Don't you know they got me rotten in the time that I'm serving? Telling you what happened the same time they're throwing. Four of us packed in a cell like slaves. Oh, well, the same motherfucker got us living in his hell. You have to realize what is the form of slavery organized under a swarm of devils. Straight up, word them up on the level. The reasons are several, most of them federal. Here's my plan anyway, and I say I got gusto, but only some I can trust, yo. Some do a bit from 1 to 10, but I never did, and plus I never been. I'm on a tier with no tears should ever fall. Cell blocked and locked, I never clock it, y'all. Cause time and time again, time they got me serving to those to them. I'm not a citizen, but ever when I catch the CO, sleeping on the job, my plan is on go ahead. I want a strength, but I'ma tell you the deal. I got nothing to lose. I'm going for the steal.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we're gonna break you out of here, man. Word of strength, G.
I'm going for that steal.
Word up, G. They're trying to put black out of the game by keeping you in there, you know what I'm saying? But they can't keep a good man down.
Got it. Got me in the cell.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we got it.
I grabbed his gun and he did what I said so. And every man's a man got served, along with the time they served. Decency was deserved. To understand my demands, I gave a warning. I wanted the governor, y'all, and plus the warden to know that I was innocent. Because I'm militant, posing a threat. You better fucking up the government. My plan said I had to get out and break north. Just like Oliver's neck, I had to get off. My boys had the feds in check. They couldn't try nothing. We had a force to instigate a prison riot. This what it takes for peace, so I just took a piece. Black for black, it's my time to cut the leash. Freedom to get out to the ghetto, no sellouts. 6 COs we got, we ought to put their head out. But I'll give them a chance, cause I'm civilized. As for rest of the world, they can't realize a cell is hell. I'm a rebel, so I rebel. Between bars got me thinking like an animal. Got a woman CO to call me a copter. She tried to get away, and I popped her twice, right? Now I wanna get nice, I had and now it's 5 to go, and I'm serious. Call me delirious, but I'm still a captive. I gotta rap, it's time to
before that spin. As I ventured into the courtyard, followed by 52 brothers, bruised, battered, and scarred, but hard. Going out with a bang, ready to bang out. The power from the sky, from the tower, shots rang out. A high number of dose, yes, it's something, cause I figure I trigger my steel stand and hold my post. This is what I mean, an anti-nigga machine. If I come out alive, then they won't come clean. Then I threw up, my steel bullets flew up. Into my surprise, the wall and tower blew up. Who shot what, who, what, the bazooka was who? Into my rescue, it was a S1W. Secure my getaway, so I just got away. The joint broke from the black smoke. Then they saw it was rougher than the average bluffer. Cause the steel was black, the attitude exact. Now the chase is on, telling you to come on. 53 brothers on the run, and we are gone.
And now, in the interest of equal time, a response from an American Defense Ministry spokesperson, dated the other day, 1988. Dear Mr. D, in our opinion, we are suckers. We are most interested in having you for our army, or whatever. We are aware that, in our visualization of your giving a damn, you are most likely to say never. This is possibly due to our being a land that never ourselves gave a damn about a brother like you or yourself. This is because we never did. Now, while it may not occur to you at this very minute, please be aware that we, the aforementioned suckers, have authority in this matter. Now, we are aware of your concerns vis-a-vis sitting in a state pen. However, we would point out that since we don't have a draft right now, while we might criticize you for some crime, the time we will have you cold sweating in your cell is in fact 0 days, and it might indeed be said that you are making an enormous fuss about nothing whatsoever. Your claim that as a black man you can never be a veteran is also open to question. Our records indicate that it did little to stop Major General Colin Powell, or that dude who was friends with Forrest Gump. Now, while you may wish to get out to the point of contemplating a plan on the cell floor, be aware that this thought has in fact been thought before and was at that point judged unnecessary, since we are not actually arresting you or charging you with anything. And the rest of your song is in reality a feeble, paranoid fantasy. Your security, or indeed that of the First World, is unaffected. Yours faithfully, the government. Oh, P.S., please stop calling yourselves public enemy number one. Our records indicate that you are, in fact, public enemy number 278,882, and that's only for stealing a large clock from a school area.
Lollardry is thought to have its linguistic roots in a Latin word for weeds. Lollards were religious heretics in the 14th and 15th centuries who said that personal piety was the only requisite for ordination, that lay people could perform the rites of the church. I think that's right. This proto-revolutionary point of view had its genesis in England and became very popular to the point where the Catholic Church saw them as springing up like weeds. Coming to you live from Luxor, as we are, we've got other deities on our minds, namely the Egyptian gods, whose tombs we can see just over there. Like Greek gods, they fell in love, got into trouble, and had particular jobs to do. Mark, what was the job of Set?
Well, this is an interesting question, because in fact, his job changed several times. The way to think about a pantheon is to think about it, it's a bit like a business, or it's like the boardroom, or the board of directors of a business. And the Egyptian pantheon especially, there were a lot of hostile mergers, it was a family business, it was quite a complicated family business. The five main directors that we know most about were, two of them were, there were two sets of married couples.
Osiris was one of them, right?
Osiris, Isis, Set, Horus, and Nephthys. Osiris and Isis were married, Set and Nephthys were married. They were all brothers and sisters.
Was the other one gay?
The other one must have been gay, yeah. I think, yes. Set also killed Osiris and tore his body into 14 pieces and buried it in various places around Egypt. And Isis had to put it back together again. And what they were actually at that point vying over for was who was in charge of human resources, which is the job.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they wanted to be the pharaoh, which is what the Egyptians called human resources. Well,
wasn't the pharaoh a earthly human being?
Later on, they gave this job to people who actually understood people better.
People management very difficult. People,
yeah.
So back in those days, the pharaoh was a god.
Well, the pharaoh was always a god.
Okay.
But the initial pharaohs were gods first and pharaoh second. The later pharaohs were pharaohs first and gods second.
Okay.
And human.
And Set after this, what shall I call it? Setback. Which was that Osiris was brought back to life and made pharaoh again, and also made Lord of the Dead. Set ended up with a bit of a grab bag of jobs, really, which include deserts, extreme weather, the erect penis, and, according to a late and somewhat suspect entry in Wikipedia, pie. But I am absolutely certain this is bogus, because in the All Hieroglyph edition of Peter Rabbit, there is a footnote in English which states unequivocally that the Egyptians had no word for pie.
Wait, you lost me there.
it's an interesting portfolio, isn't it?
Peter Rabbit?
Yeah.
Yes, the British Museum puts out a hieroglyph edition of Peter Rabbit, which is a very
really?
Nice and rather expensive real-life item, which I certainly recommend.
Yeah. So, could you compare Egyptian gods to a soccer team, maybe, where some of the gods are specialists in certain things?
I think all pantheons, you can compare them to teams where, yes, certainly. If you look at the Celtic pantheon, there's a god of apple trees called Abellio. Sorry, I went off mic there because I couldn't remember. And in the Mayan pantheon, there's a god who I really have to read this. It's Itzcalcolliuqui Ixquimili. That's his name.
Oh, well, probably got some clicks in it, too.
Is the god of hard rock.
Yes!
this is one of the problems I find with a lot of these pantheons is that people in retro... It's like saints, when they retrofit a job onto a saint. So, you know, when you have a saint who is suddenly the saint of the internet, who, let's be fair, wasn't really around in the early days of the World Wide Web. In fact, when they were around, they probably didn't even know the world was wide. You know, so I think that's strange. I mean,
well, as gods, they're surely simultaneously inside and outside time. I mean, saints, that's
set in Doctor Who was.
I completely agree, because saints aren't outside time, obviously. Set appeared in Doctor Who, but his name was
Sutek.
Sutek. Yes.
And what did he look like on Doctor Who?
Yes.
again, there's all sorts of complexities here, and as we know, the Egyptian gods are famous many of them, for appearing with animal heads. Although
right.
apparently this is in their representation rather than in their ordinary life. They took their heads off.
Like an eagle or a...
Well, I don't think there's... I don't. There may be an eagle, but
something.
The... Thoth is an ibis, has an ibis's head. Mm-hmm. Anubis has a jackal's head.
Jackal, right, that's interesting.
Set has, according to some sources, they say this is a composite beast. The LaRousse Dictionary of Mythology says it's the Typhonian beast, and then explains at some length what Typhonian means, which is no help at all, because
yeah.
it doesn't actually tell you what it looks like. What it actually has is modern... viewers would recognize it straight away. It's the head of a clanger.
Now, what's a clanger? What's a clanger?
A clanger is a small pink knitted animal which lives on a moon-like planet and was largely active during the 1970s. It has a long, thin snout and ears which it can position according to mood.
Wow, talk about really existing outside time.
Mm. Very
no, awesome.
I mean, it is, I suppose it is quite close to an aardvark in some ways. But
there are no aardvarks in Egypt.
No,
or on
there
the moon.
Are no aardvarks in Egypt or the moon. So.
Are you sure there aren't any aardvarks in Egypt?
No, still no. I didn't look that up. But I think that if it had been an aardvark, because it does look a bit like one, why are all these experts so uncertain? Aardvark is raised, but they say it could be an aardvark. But if there are aardvarks in Egypt, then it is an aardvark. Mm. So the fact that they're saying could be means there can't be.
Mm.
Is there when it comes to when you're talking about pantheisms like that, is there a reason why certain cultures, I mean, went for pantheism as you say, this sort of company like structure, rather than, you know, later when we get into monotheisms with your single all-knowing ever-loving God who does bugger all? But I mean, you go back to the Egyptians, or you got the Greeks and so on, where they had these pantheons. Is there a reason for that, do you think?
I think pantheons are a really important and useful thing. And
so why don't we have them anymore?
Well, we do have them, but we have them in much more everyday popular usage.
That
a lot of our popular culture, rock bands, superhero comics, just the way we think about films and TV is to do with putting together teams of collective creativity.
Uh-huh.
100 years ago, creativity was thought of as authorial, and there was one person creating the whole thing. But in fact, we're much more interested in things to do with teams. Big Brother to Buffy to whatever. The idea of the team is the thing that we're actually very interested in.
And Mark, you've got a song for us by Mummy the Peep Show.
I have. Well, I thought, well, I'm talking about Egypt, so let's pick something which is Egyptian in theme. And these are a Japanese all-girl pop group called Mummy the Peep Show.
All right. back to snacks and our irregular... Oh, by the way, that was Rock Me Bartender by Mummy the Peep Show. We've got now our irregular feature, Ask Dr. Brand, where you get to ask our international marketing expert, Dr. Brand, your pressing marketing queries. Doctor?
Lunchtime, marketers everywhere. I'm Dr. Brand, and I'm here to leverage your curiosity and optimize your knowledge with actionable solutions to your burning branding issues. This week's marketing puzzler comes from Rick, who asks, why are chocolate bars named after space things, but not after dinosaurs? Good question, Rick. Space and dinosaurs are both topics with a high share of brain among chocolate's child demographic. But we have Mars, Galaxy, and Milky Way bars on our shelves, and T-Rexes, Brando bars, and Chocosaurus sweets are unknown. Are marketers missing a trick? Over to our panel for some idea generation.
So let's brainstorm here, people. What do you think, Kat? Why don't we have dinosaur chocolates when there's all these space things around?
They clearly all melted when the meteorite came rocketing to Earth and the temperature got too high and the chocolate melted.
Ah, so you think sort of the space chocolates kind of destroyed the dinosaur chocolates?
Yes.
And it must be extinct. Clearly it's extinct because of that.
Wait, so you're saying that, is that your answer as well?
No. My answer is very clear because the confusion between what would be a T-Rex bar and Trex, a common late 70s, early 80s, still covered extra from your mother, which is basically suet. So a youngster might go into the kitchen, ooh, I'm going to have a T-Rex bar. What they're actually eating is pure animal fat.
Okay, Pete. Mark?
As opposed to vegetable fat. Well, I think it's a parental thing that in fact, if you had a Triceratops bar, it would clearly have to be very long. And the parents, they don't mind having their children having a bar which is like 6 inches long, but a bar which is 18 inches long is...
You mean to get the detail in there?
Kind to of. Get the word on.
Oh, to get the word on the front. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Brontosaurus, Tyrannosaurus. It's very, very long words.
There's a little bit at the end.
Okay, so Mark says the words would be too long and the bars would be too big. Pete says that people would mistake it for Trex, a suet treat. And Kat says that clearly the comets came down and destroyed all the chocolate dinosaurs a long time ago. Let's see if Dr. Brand agrees.
Hope you enjoyed that breakout time. Dr. Brand here with the expert view. Rick's question is in fact profoundly misguided. The Mars bar isn't named after a space thing at all. It's named after its creator, Forrest Mars, who invented the bar in the 1920s. Had he been called Forrest Glyptodon, the history of chocolate marketing might have been very different. As it was, rivals Leon Galaxy and Scott's confectioner Milky Way moved to put their own bars on the market, and the rest is branding history. A happy accident, though, as after all, space is the perfect branding partner for choc bars. It's big and empty, just like a stomach.
Each week, our Lollards plunge into thickets of myth and circumstance, hoping to emerge with the raw materials of science. Today, Kat Stevens has been rummaging in the book room, otherwise known as the library, I think, and returns with something to say about badgers.
Yes. Well, I have been reading many children's books over my life, not just during my childhood, but continuing to this present day.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed a theme. I have.
What is it?
Well, in all children's books that I've been reading that cover UK woodland-based animals. All these the animal characters, they seem to follow a pattern, in fact, or they fall into the same old set. And you would get a fox that would be cunning, you would get an owl,
yes,
that was wise. Rabbits seem to be very sort of, you know, scatterbrained and, you know, sort of single-minded.
Yes.
And yes, I was just wondering why badgers are so grumpy. though in every single children's book I've read that features a badger, they seem to be very sort of miserly, old, you know, set in their ways, if you will.
What are some of these books where the badgers appear in?
Well, there is the Animals of Farthing Wood books, where you know, all the other characters, they, you know, pair off with a sort of a, you know, a fox who gets a lady friend, Vixen, who's, you know, very saucy. And
sorry, this is Farthing Woods.
But yes, the Animals of Farthing Wood.
The Animals of Farthing
Woods by Colin Dann. It's a series of books that got made into a children's television cartoon a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And yes, but all the other animals are, you know, they sort of end up pairing off, but the badger is, you know, sitting there grumpy. It's like, oh, no, I hate everyone. I'm just going to, like, go to sleep in my set.
Is that an authentic badger voice? Is that the way badgers talk?
It's the way fictional badgers are.
Fictional badgers talk. Yeah. And it's the same in other books as well. Like, in the Little Grey Rabbit books by Alison Attlee, then there's, you know, the badger in there. It's like, well, I don't really like people, but I'll put up with these young upstarts, you know, this rabbit that keeps coming around and trying to take thorns out of my paw or whatever. And yeah, it's The Wind in the Willows as well. Uh-huh. The famous badger in there is always very grumpy indeed.
He's specifically stated to be a confirmed bachelor.
Indeed.
Although he does have quite an interest in Ratty, who's also a confirmed bachelor and water-going rat.
We'll leave you to make your own conclusions about that one. And I was wondering, I was trying to see if there was a badger in Beatrix Potter, because I couldn't remember reading about one. But there is a badger featuring the tale of Mr. Todd, where he's not actually called Badger, funnily enough. Most of these books seem to just have the name of the animal.
He's called Mr. Brock, isn't he?
He's called Tommy Brock.
Tommy Brock.
Tommy
right.
Brock. And he's not just grumpy, he's evil.
Yes, he's very nasty.
He wants to kill and eat Benjamin Bunny's children.
Would there be a way of altering maybe a badger's state of mind, do you think, you know, that would make it feel better for it?
I don't know. There must be one way of cheering them up. And I found a song, actually.
What's it called?
It's called Badgers on Acid.
Let's listen.
Badger, mushroom.
So that's Sifoon, K-Complex, and Ting with Badgers on Acid. Now, Kat, let's just back up for a second. And this idea of animals portraying certain human cliches of human personality.
They're falling into these stereotypes. And obviously in children's literature, then it's, you know, it's easy for the author to, you know, fall into this pattern. And the kids will already know that a fox is meant to be clever and, you know, brave and adventurous. Yeah. And so they will readily identify with that character. They'll recognize that character.
Sort of see themselves in a certain...
So if you're a, you know, children's writer, it's obviously you don't want to get bogged down in sort of like big character descriptions, because you want your book to be full of action and plot.
So it's a kind of easy way to say this is what this character's like. And
it's an easy way, and it's kind of a lazy way as well. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the sacrifice that you make balancing, you know, character development versus action, and, you know, you've got to weigh that up.
Now, how do badgers get stuck with this? Are badgers really like this?
I don't know. In real life, badgers are quite grumpy. A fox will generally, even town foxes will kind of run away if you sort of shout at them. But badgers will actually come and bite your finger off and then
town badgers.
And well, yeah. and they'll give you tuberculosis because they don't like you.
One of the interesting things is that the idea of mapping animals on certain characteristics, like, you know, the idea of being clever or cunning, but you know that some of those go back to Aesop and stuff like that. But there are clearly some which map to a very small minor part of like human existence, like the hedgehogs as washerwoman motif, yes. Which seems to exist in quite a lot of books. Why is wash day so important to kids, and B, why hedgehogs?
Well, hedgehogs actually have a very long history in stereotyping. That Isaiah Berlin has this famous essay where he quotes the Greek poet Archilochus, who said in a fragment that the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing.
How to clean clothes.
Well, that was going to be my question. What's the big thing that the hedgehog knows? I guess cleaning clothes is pretty big.
Well, only if animals wear clothes. And animals, of course, shouldn't wear clothes.
Fuzzy Peck certainly wore a little blue coat because his spines stick up through it.
This is Fuzzy Peck from the Little Grey Rabbit
Fuzzy
books.
Fuzzy Peck, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously the spines are a useful addition if you're trying to, you know, keep clothes on. I remember Peter Rabbit had problems keeping his jacket on, and it led to his downfall because I think Mr. McGregor found a shoe or something and said, he's been after my carrots again.
I think the hedgehog was the designated clothes operative because it was the animal which found it easiest, in fact found it hardest to take their clothes off because
Indeed.
They're stuck on. Pinny Pricklepin also wore a little blue coat with spikes going through.
Yeah, it's right spotting through. Another theme here. Again, it's a stereotyping of children's characters. You know, that does go all the way back to Aesop. And even like the Bible with, there is a mention of badgers in Exodus.
Really?
I think it might be lost in translation, but apparently one was instructed to cover one's tent with badger skin.
Well, the original lyrics of Bob Marley's Exodus is Movement of the Badgers.
Indeed. Also, there's a fox in Ezekiel. I think someone is compared to a fox.
I've just realised what that animal is. It's not a clanger that Set represents. One of the things that we always forget about very old carvings and things like that is that at the time they were painted, but obviously the paint, especially in the hot Egyptian sun, has flaked off many centuries ago.
All over there.
Set was painted black and white on his snout. He's not a clanger, he's a badger.
Right,
of course,
yeah.
Hence, do you see?
It makes an awful little sense, actually, when you say it like that.
Also, this is just a fact that I seem to remember. Either Aesop or Archilochus, I can't remember which, was killed by a bird dropping a tortoise on his head.
I think it was Archilochus.
Yeah, it was Archilochus, wasn't
I think
it?
So, yes.
Unfortunately, otherwise, the great tale of the bird and the tortoise would never have been written properly. But yeah, but I mean, because Archilochus was one of Aesop's biggest rivals, so it's quite possible that Aesop did set this all up because he had his animal familiars and sat down with them and said, okay, I want a tortoise, okay, I'll let you win the race, but you've got to do one thing for him if you win the race, and that's fly above Killikus's head, be dropped, bang, smash guy open, I become the fable king. And he is, you know,
he is the fable king.
Yes.
But I mean, the sort of, it's, are there any other animals that sort of come in? When is there sort of an extension when you go out into other when you go to Africa and stuff like that, lions and...
Well, yes, obviously, like, children's books in English, the traditional ones, are all written about UK animals, so even if they've got a higher significance, like the weasels in Wind and Willows being communists or something like that. You do get things from further afield, like lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Waiting for that.
Sorry.
But they don't seem to have the same moral mapping that the tiny folk of the woodland do.
Getting back to Egypt, I think it's quite interesting that the heads which are chosen for the gods are quite unexpected. The goddess of love has a cow's head, which is, if you're thinking that Hathor is somehow maps onto Venus, Venus with a cow's head would seem peculiar in non-Egyptian concepts of
it's the udders.
Stereotypes.
It's all about the udders.
All right, folks, it's time for the new UK number one, as determined by the new rules, which allow download-only tracks to scream up the charts. If you've been paying close attention, this is the third reference now to the third version of the song Jeans On, this time by Leo Sayer.
Hello, everybody. Put on your blue jeans right now and feel this.
And I break down. jeans on. I pulled my old blue jeans on. I pulled my blue jeans on. I pulled my old blue jeans on.
Uh-huh. Like the sky, navy blue, baby blue, go but dance you hot. Close to you, I come to get some spice up in my life. You and me with blue jeans, know it's time not to ride. Can't wait, need to take it, can't be late for the party. Hot, we will make it, come closer, let's get nuts.
You've been listening to Pete Barron, Kate Stevens, and Mark Sinker.
Kate.
Tim Hopkins.
Kat.
Did I just say Kate?
Yeah.
Yes. Excuse me. I've written Kat. Tim Hopkins was our producer this week. You can find Freaky Trigger on the web at freakytrigger.co.uk. We've been broadcasting live from Luxor and now head to the streets of Gibraltar and the Pillars of Hercules. Stay tuned for the Other Woman, all-female playlist selected by Ruth Barnes, followed by Calling All Pensioners and the Rocket 88 Doo-Wop Rock and Roll Show, which begins today at 3. Today's show was brought to you by the word SET. I'm Elisha Sessions, and thanks for listening.